Hello and welcome to the Dancecast, where I explore dance as an art form, traveling to non-traditional places and with non-traditional doers. I'm your host and my name is Silva Lakkonen. Welcome to Dancecast episode 38. I'm continuing with my theme of danceability teachers around the world, and in this episode I spoke with Aaron Wheeler Kay, who lives in Portland, Oregon, where he is the creative director of Echo Theatre Company. Echo Theatre Company is a non-profit with a focus on combining different performance disciplines, including circus arts, dance, and devised theatre, to produce original performance works. Aaron teaches dance, acrobatics, and aerial arts to people of all ages. He became certified to teach danceability in 2016.
Okay, my name is Aaron Wheeler Kay.
Aaron Wheeler Kay.
Okay. I often tell my students, like, to fill a balloon, you have to put Aaron. Yeah, it's just a way to remember, but you know, it comes from like Hebrew, so it's more like Aaron or Aharon, but everybody here just says Aaron.
Well, welcome to Dancecast.
Thank you.
So tell me a little bit about yourself. How did you end up in the dance world, in the performing world, in the aerial world? You're in circus, you're involved in so many. I mean, I've been doing a little bit of research on you. And
yes. So I was lucky. There was dance in my public school. So in sixth grade, I started taking a dance class that was jazz 3 days a week and ballet twice a week. And really, I don't know why I kept doing it, because I was in a school. There were no other boys taking class. I was in a school that was like only 15% white people. It was a magnet school, and so I was in class with all black girls who all knew how to dance, so it was very intimidating, but something about it just really hooked me. And so I continued through middle school, and then those classes were part of a outreach program in a performance arts high school, so I went to high school and also received free dance education through public schools in Portland. And by the end of high school, I was just very enamored with dance. I went to New York to study concert dance at Alvin Ailey American Dance Center, and ended up staying a little under a year there and came back to Portland, and wasn't really doing a lot with dance. You know, as a young person, I got a job. I was working for a bakery, and then there was an audition for a local company, and they combined theater and dance and circus, and I had some theater experience too, so I got a job apprenticing and then as an employee of this company. And I just I've been there now 22 years. So it just luck and the right timing. So that's that. I continue to learn and study from people in the company with different disciplines, clowning, aerial work. And I began apprenticing as a teacher. So I kind of had an old fashioned apprenticeship. And then the school that we teach has always had a very teach whomever will come.
I see.
But no real direct training, just learning from each other, learning from students. So about 5 years ago, our company went through a big change. We got a new executive director, and she put a postcard on my desk for a teacher orientation, a 1 week, 30-hour intensive in danceability that was happening at a local college. And I just kept looking at that postcard, and it seemed like a good thing. It seemed the right thing to try. And from the first, from the first exercise, from the first class, the first day, I just felt the great potential of this work. Alita was teaching it, and it was the experience that week was very transformative for me. And just it drew me back. I immediately began applying principles into my classes. I teach adults and youth, and it just applied in so many places. And then when the opportunity came up to get the teacher certification, my work was very accommodating. They gave me the month to go to Eugene. My family, I have two young children. We all agreed we could make it work. And And Danceability actually gave me a partial scholarship, which was really helpful because I work for a nonprofit. So it just one thing led to another. And then following that experience, I ended up being able to attend the master teacher certification in Trier a couple of years later. And so even though I only came to Danceability about 4 years ago, I jumped in with both feet and really so much of it was and after years of taking all these different kinds of dance, to be in a class where it wasn't concerned with the development of my future self. It was just concerned with where I was that day and who was in class with me. That was very freeing. Around the same time I found Danceability, my wife was badly injured with a very, very bad leg break. So she was temporarily disabled. And so we were just living this experience of access and mobility challenges. So everything was, and I'm now 43. I was recognizing like today our body and this understanding that there would be a place for us and that I could help cultivate and keep that place alive, you know, was all of those things together.
Wow.
Yeah.
I love you spoke in another video about the, how dance is so much about the development of your future self. But you really felt that Danceability was about the gift and the who we are right now today and with whom we are. And I thought that I've never heard that put that way, but I immediately felt the connection to that statement.
Huh. Oh, good. Yeah. Yes, go.
And the enormous freedom that come with the fact that this is not something that somebody's going to tell you where your end is and then you're mastering it. It's a path that never ends.
Yes. And I think that I could discern early that Danceability wasn't directly about disability. Mm. Like I easily mixed up the idea that Danceability was somehow related to helping disabled people. And it didn't take very long to be sort of disabused of that notion that it was for everybody the way access is for everybody. But I think that that in exploring Danceability and getting to know people of different ways of being and different backgrounds, different histories, different limitations and different disabilities, I also couldn't ignore issues of disability justice and access. Outside of Danceability too. So I think it was also it was a way to open my eyes and my heart to the nature of access and to the lack of access in so many places. And so those two have continued to be learning sort of simultaneous learning paths, one learning to teach this discipline and then also learning to stay engaged with access issues. And so I'm a very privileged person. I work in an arts organization. I have the title creative director. So I have a lot of power over what we explore and what we put in front of the audience. And so I think discovering Danceability also has had a strong impact on my sense of how to leverage my privilege to feature other people's stories and other people's experiences. And it really changed the way I make work and whom I'm making work with. And so that's also been a very wonderful expansion of my awareness and my learning.
Yeah. So you taught the company is called Echo Theater, right?
Mm-hmm.
Saying it right. Echo Theater Company.
Yes.
And you said you'd be with them over 20 years.
Yes. They used to have a different name. We're in a building called the Echo Theater.
Oh, okay.
We were working under the name Do Jump, like the opposite of Don't Jump. And that artistic director left the organization and took the name and began her own nonprofit called Do Jump. So we rebranded, but we had the same building, the same equipment, the same students and new opportunity to inform the direction, a group of us, the education director and myself. I'm sorry, what was your question?
No, it was just about the history of Echo Theater.
Yes.
So, and now you have landed here and you have started.
Yes, so I began as a performer and teacher. I didn't get involved with directing professional work until the last 5 or 6 years. So
I see. Yeah, and I saw some of your warm up, and it's the language sounded very much like danceability, even for your aerial classes, where you sort of sink into your own body.
Yes, that it. I said it. It's true. It's really impacted my approach. It's been interesting. So working in circus arts or adjacent to circus arts, it's not inherently inclusive. I think it part of the appeal of circus has to do somewhat with its maybe inaccessibility is the wrong word, but the virtuosity, the challenge, the exploration of the athletic, the traditional athletic body. And so for something that's inherently exclusive, it's been interesting for me to try to look at what we're doing from an inclusivity lens. And so there's a lot of places in our town, in Portland, Oregon, to study circus arts. And most of them, I think, are having a more traditional
I love drive. That cat.
Yeah, that's my cat is very vocal.
He or she is also participating in the conversation.
Yes, I don't want to be left. I think what I mean to say, I'm trying not to be negative about what these other studios offer because it's very empowering for people. But I think that what we've been continuing to do is say, who else? Who else might want this experience? How else can we explore the potential of our physical body when it's tethered to something, when it's tied to a point, or when it's tied to another person? Or so, and that has proven to, as we first thought, when I first met Alito, and I said, oh, I'm so fascinated by this work. I work in circus arts, and I'd like to find this way in. He had a very astute question. He said, well, are you just going to be giving people rides, or is there some way for them to have agency? And I think this was a very important question for me to hear at the beginning of thinking about this, because of course my first thought had been, oh, I could connect somebody and we could pull them up and down and they can feel going up and down. But his question made me really reexamine how one's experience might be and how we might give people agency. And it was an important question, and I had to think about it a lot, but I'm really glad I did.
That's a really great question. That's what I actually love about Alito. He does not shy away from like pushing you against the wall from the moment you meet him. So he's definitely there with his questions. Because I think it is the most important thing, because also what my mind goes easily is like freak shows. So that you don't end up going to that route, and here we are too, you know, able-bodied people talking about it, so
right.
But I think that's very important to think about the representation and the agency.
Yes, and of course circus does have a history of the sideshow,
yeah,
and the show and being separate from the big top, and it looks now like there's more globally that there's more blending and blurring of those lines, which I think is a positive thing. But I agree, there's in circus arts, there's been a tokenization or fetishization of the freak show aspects. And while that doesn't provide some people with employment, it continues to objectify them in a way that they maybe don't have any real control over. So, so I think that is, and certainly just like I think anybody who's exploring access, like I certainly made missteps. I'm still learning.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's something we able-bodied just have to be fine with it. You know, like that the mistakes are constant and happen and are actually part of the learning process.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you currently have any people with disabilities taking classes?
Yes. One thing that's been interesting about – so when I got certified to teach, the first thing I wanted to do was to teach as many of our staff as I could. So I led the 30-hour introduction to
– Oh, that is so wonderful.
Yeah, like 10 members of our staff, which kept me from being so isolated in the knowledge.
Yes.
And just the language and the ethos and all of that. And so that contributed to a little shift in our corporate culture. And also just by beginning this process, we discovered there's more people on our staff who identify with invisible illnesses or invisible disabilities. So that was a new discovery for me and for people to be forthcoming about that. Our technical director, the person that I work most closely with in designing lights and doing sound, and she's a disabled person. And so that I knew, but she's become much more comfortable in our community. She has auditory and sensory hallucinations sometimes, and she's much more comfortable saying, "Do you guys all smell this thing I'm smelling?" Or am I, you know, yeah, before I think she felt less comfortable doing that.
You have created more accessible space, obviously, by doing this.
I'm participating, yeah, in more accessible space. And we've been, our theater is built inside an old silent movie house, and so it's a great venue for rentals. So we've also been trying to help people who have less access get access to the space. I mean, we just lucked out in a sense that our building is accessible, mm-hmm. that it's a ground floor doorway, that there aren't stairs, that we have an accessible bathroom. It just like, I just luckily we didn't have to do a lot of work or invest a lot of money up front in making the space more accessible, but we still have challenges. Our dressing room bathroom is downstairs and our booth is not accessible to wheelchairs. So there's room to grow. But to answer your first question, what we'd been finding before I directly engaged with learning danceability was that we were just getting more and more students with different ways of being intellectually, not necessarily people identifying as disabled, but kids with processing or sequencing challenges or proximity challenges, or, you know, there's a host of people across, especially autism spectrum. People were finding that if they brought students to our school, those students were just incorporated into class and we weren't doing something different to specifically focus on kids of a certain way. We just had a nature to invite everybody and kind of work through how to learn together, but without some of those great tools that danceability has for assessing. And so what we're seeing is that our reputation is growing as we do better work. When I have opportunities to do creative work, the last 3 or 4 years, I've focused on including some point of access in production. It's a slow process, but I think that is helping people see more diversity on stage, and then it lends itself to more people coming to classes. So though I know many deaf people don't, you know, capital D deaf, don't identify as disabled, we've seen more deaf students coming into our programming. We've begun working with ASL interpreters in some of our classes. And our last show was a collaboration with artists from deaf communities. So I think that it is happening, and it's happening at the right pace. In some ways it feels slower than I wish, because I want more people to know that it's welcome. And at the same time, we all have learning and growth to do. So, so we just have to grow at the pace we can. But short answer, I could remember when disability training, I remembered like 5 or 6 years prior, we'd had a student who came to a summer camp with one arm. And I didn't notice the student had one arm until the second day. And we're doing Chinese class. They were just a very engaged student. And I was just off my radar somehow. And so when I look back, I can also see that we've had space, but not focus. Mm. So I think now that we're honing our focus and our narrative, finding a way to get this story out into the communities that we're here. But the truth is, the most danceability I'm teaching is outside of our organization. It's going to other organizations and working with people in different places as a representative of our space. But
so doing lots of outreach work.
Yes, yes.
sense.
Yeah, we've been offering classes through our local community college, and so that's one place we've inserted our danceability class, and that hasn't like taken off the way that our aerial classes have. And so I think part of that is just people not knowing how good it is. You know what I mean? It's
you like, don't understand.
there's some sort of barrier to people trying it. So yeah, I've had much more success with larger classes and more people involved by partnering with groups who've been doing access work longer and have deeper roots in communities.
Yeah. I love this idea of just creating an accessible and open space with the focus on it, and that it has then just lend itself to communities and people finding you instead of trying to, you know, my work is mostly in a way of going to communities, teaching there, and then saying, hey, by the way, there is this as well.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's really lovely to see, and the way you talk about it and to name, you know, that you think we always had an open space, but we just never focused on it. An inviting space for all, but never focused on it. I think it's just a beautiful way of putting it.
Mm-hmm. And I think so many of the people who work with us, I mean, circus is this way too. I think a lot of arts communities, you know, they're places where marginalized people arrive or people with trauma come because it's somehow safer than other spaces. And so in some ways, arts communities are a little bit, have some advantage in who makes them up, also creative thinkers and open minds. Although it's not an easy process for anybody. I think partly because I think it's still everybody wants the checklist. Once you've checked off all the things, now you can say, okay, we're accessible. We did that work, and now we can go back to our other work. And it's actually adopting a lifelong learner's approach to continually reassessing,
yes.
You know, meeting new ways of being and saying, okay, how does that dovetail, or how do we make that space happen? Yeah.
But, you know, I think I know nothing about circus culture, but I've been really looking into the social psychology part of authority and obedience in dance culture, where the teacher is the one who says what is good and what is right. And that is the way to do things. So I think there is also, at least in dance, there's that culture to sort of change. So the change is not only to allow people with different bodies and thinking to come to your space, but also let go of that idea of authority telling you what's right.
Right.
So I think the change is just like enormous.
Yes, yes, I agree. One of the things that immediately caught my attention had to do with how we deal with emotions in class, because I work with a lot of teenagers. We have two youth performance companies of younger, older
kids. Ones?
Yeah. Like 8 to 14-year-olds and then 12 to 18-year-olds.
Oh, wonderful.
Roughly, that mostly on skill level, but also age. And when we had the discussion in class about how, like, you know, if someone bursts into laughter in class, the whole class doesn't stop and rescue that person, right? Like, they're just having an emotional response. They laugh and we move on. But tears is, that's not how we respond traditionally. In every dance class I've ever been in, right, it becomes a drama for us to all share. And so when you know, Alita's, oh, people can cry class, they can stay and cry, or if they need to leave, they'll leave, or, you know, if they need comfort, they'll ask for it, but we just keep doing class. This was a revolution for me. And just yesterday I was teaching a group of youth performers, and at the beginning of class, someone was in circle openly weeping, and we just had class all day. She continued to come and go from crying throughout the day, but we didn't stop and figure it out. And she participated,
fix it.
Right. And no one else in class did either, which makes me think that we've been demonstrating this long enough that they are getting it. And so it didn't become a focus, and she still had space, but she also got to be in her body that day and participate and collaborate. And I was thinking of danceability throughout class because of that. I was like, see, it works. It works. Like, we don't have to give her sadness so much. And then no one else can get their job done. And so I almost daily continue to see the wisdom of that teaching seeping into our communities and affecting the work. And it's in a really positive way.
Yeah, you broke up there a little bit. You were saying, see, we don't have to give to her sadness.
We don't have to focus her sadness. We don't have to mobilize around it. We don't have to give it so much power and attention. And then maybe it is just a little bit sad. You know, it doesn't have to be this drama. Or maybe she has big things going on, but maybe she has a place she can go to just release that a little bit and still be in her body and still be in community with others. And just do her own processing without it being a public, you know, catharsis. Mm-hmm. She can just cry quietly and we can keep doing class. And I know that's directly from the teachings of Alito that I was exposed to. So.
Yeah. How is the work with teenagers? Is it challenging?
It's funny you know, teenagers are people. It's not that different. I mean, I think that...
I don't know. I have a 9-year-old, 7-year-old, and 4-year-old. And the 9-year-old is, you know...
Yes.
He's starting to become this teenager. I'm not quite sure if they're people. But
I know. So, yes, my older child, Lily, is 10. And, yes, I'm feeling these... I think, though, that... From a parenting perspective, and luckily I taught for years before I became a parent, but we keep acquiring new skills and we want to know where the boundary is.
Yeah.
And then we get enough skills or age or wisdom or experience and we are clearly have evolved outside of that old boundary and we need to know where the new boundary is. And so I think that, you know, like my son is 7 years old. He's steeped in growth hormones all the time. He's raging on testosterone sometimes. He's just smaller than a teenager, but he's very, you know, he has all the same access to emotional swings and to being overwhelmed by the world. So he's just not that big yet. But I'm lucky, like I'm teaching trapeze. And so these students want that from me in a way they probably don't want mathematics you know, so I'm a little bit of a lucky situation. But what I find is, like, you know, teenagers in general, and I primarily work with people who identify as girls, but their needs aren't different than other people. They want to be understood. They want some space. They want their feelings to be honored. They want their dreams to be indulged a little bit. You know, it's so I think that something I've been only learning the last few years, I've been teaching now about 20 years, is that because real education is relationship based, you need enough time to have a relationship to get into the deeper teachings, I think. You need time. You need time and you need a relationship with a teacher. And so I think many of us, our interactions with teenagers are at the beginning, and that you don't have enough time. We also don't have very many places to be in community with teenagers. I mean, in our culture, in the United States, there's no place for teenagers to go, right? Like, they can't go to a playground on an elementary school, even, you know, they're not welcome there. They're questioned if they're out late at night. There's not a lot of space for them, really, unless they're involved in a discipline, a sport or a dance or music. So I think it's hard. I know it was hard when I was young and I had a lot of support. So what I like about working with teenagers is they're passionate, and a lot of them are paying attention, and they want agency. They want some decision making and to be understood as people who do have something to contribute. So, you know, so I think also one of the great gifts that danceability has given me as just a person functioning is to meet each person with a little bit different kind of openness than I had before. especially with the knowledge of invisible disabilities, you never know what someone's situation is. I didn't really understand this as well before I became a parent, but I would teach kids in after school programs and be like, for an hour. I'm only asking you to pay attention to me for an hour. But it's because they already spent their whole day doing what everybody told them to do. They want a little room to play. So I think that a value in our programming is teaching how to assess risk so that you can take risks with some examination. And so I like working with teenagers because they like usually to have something risky of a physical nature, a certain kind of physical challenge. But you can also introduce these emotional risks of being vulnerable in front of other people or being challenged to think of your body as enough the way it is. You know, these, I think, and because teenagers haven't necessarily fully formed their idea about how the world works or is, they still have openness. It's just, I think in our most of our social interactions with teenagers, we don't have room to get there. I mean, I know that I used to feel pretty threatened or just nervous being in a teen dominated space.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's sad. Teenagers shouldn't be so scary. You know? These people who need help like all of us. But I like the work we do is very collaborative, and it's trying to decide as a group what the important things to explore are. And so I love those conversations. You know, what is worth our audience's attention? Well, how do we make this meaningful to them and keep it meaningful to us? So I like those conversations.
That is great. So what is the dream that you have with Echo Theater and with your work? What is the ultimate, like, you know, we talked about not look in the future and put yourself into things. But I mean, we all have to have dreams and goals to reach.
Right, to think aspirational.
Yeah. Yeah. So what are some of yours and what comes to your work?
Yeah. So one hope I have is to just to have more of a presence in the arts community in our town, to just have more people know. I think we're relatively unknown despite our longevity. So that's a basic one, to just be able to reach more people. To continue seeing the diversity of experience grow in our classes and in our programming, in our professional programming and in our staff, you know, to really continue to invite and find access at all levels of the organization, not just as a student or as a collaborative performer, but like we have, you know, someone with a disability who is in our technical theater capacity. They're in a better position to help teach people with different sets of limitations probably than an average technical director. So I have for the future, like I would want to be able to step away eventually and see it continue with more people who are passionate about this and are still exploring access. I'd love to have an automatic door on our building. Well, this small things, but that's like a $10,000 small thing. So, And to just be part of the changing underlying ethos of our culture. I want our work to impact our culture in a positive way. So, you know, I mean, I want the building to still exist. I want people to be empowered and to feel at home in their bodies. And then I want to gain comfort with others, with anybody who's otherized, to continue expanding my capacity to know and accept people and to see that grow in the community, to have more and more people who are. What I would really like is to see more light bulbs going on in people's minds that access is so good for everybody. The last show we did, we had a deaf composer and a deaf performer. So using interpreters in rehearsals, the best practice was to speak one voice at a time. And that way the person who needs access through sign language interpreting, they're really only having to access one voice at a time. And so is the interpreter. But that's so good for everybody.
Oh my God, what a revelation.
Right? Like, we're all getting the information at the same time. There's less cross-talking. There's better unified focus. So, I have yet to bump into an access point that doesn't like that. You know what I mean? That doesn't make it better for everybody. In the U.S., we have what are called curb cuts, you know, like a little shallow cut into the edge where it meets the street, where the curb meets the street. Meets the street. We only have those because the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act, passed, and eventually they did this. But homeless people with shopping carts, toddlers, people on roller skates, mothers with strollers, like everybody prefers the curb to do that.
Yeah.
So that's what I'd really like to see change, is people's understanding about what access is. I still, even with very attention people, want to, oh, that's so good for them, or, oh, that's such valuable work you're doing for those people. And so what I don't think I'm alone in this dream, but to see the whole idea about access changing, because when it makes room for all of us, we all feel better. A practice we've adopted is similar to what we do in danceability. I learned it through a different organization, but an access check-in. So when we first get together to do any project, we just check in. What are people's needs? What will help people feel comfortable or understood or successful? So I do that with almost every class now. And in Portland, it's a place where people may be identifying with a pronoun that we wouldn't assume. And so just anything you want to share before we get going.
Yeah, it is powerful.
What I've seen is by repeating that practice, it's powerful. So I just want to see that continue to grow. Every time that I learn about some new inclusive practice or approach or language, it expands my thinking and worldview, and it's good. And so, so my hope for the future is that we continue to develop physically confident, self-accepting, creative problem solvers who have the idea that we'll continue to learn and grow, and that inclusion is for all of us. And I think I want to see that message grow.